place.
Attention, attention. You are listening to a pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. Curious Realm is busy traveling the vast void of time and space to find the best paradigm-changing content the universe has to offer. Enjoy the following transmission, and remember, stay curious. Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this very, very special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. I am currently on the road, actively attending. I just arrived, actually, as this happens. I am bilocating at the 9/11 conference with Richard Gage and the 9/11 Truth Movement up there. It's going to be a fantastic few days of coverage. Our guests tonight are fantastic. In our first segment, we are more than happy to welcome back our good friend Lyle Blackburn. You can find all of his work, videos, books, as well as his very, very popular Monstro Bizarro podcast over at lyleblackburn.com. He is here tonight to talk about wild men, not just here in America, but all over the world. Welcome back to the show, Lyle. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Glad to be back.
Always glad to have you here, man. I was actively just perusing the other day your Lizard Man book, and that's part of what popped this up in my head. I know we had talked about Lizard Man. I guess one of the last Facebook messages I had with you was me on the road watching Unexplained, and I was like, hey, look at that, there's Lyle talking about Lizard Man. Yeah. And that made me pop that book out and start reading about it. But here lately, the topic of wild men has come up a few times in my conversations with people, and I was like, you know, I know Lyle and Chester were doing some work on that, so I wanted to have you on to discuss things and some of the numerous cases, not just recently, but throughout the past, that have included wild men, Lyle.
Yeah, that's kind of a topic that's always fascinated me. It just sort of like that, the feral human aspect that you get into when you research cryptids, notably Bigfoot, you know, because when you start going backwards, there's stories of what they would call wild men that the descriptions would kind of be somewhere between a huge hairy beast and, you know, perhaps a feral person. You know, it's hard to kind of determine, but, you know, those cases always fascinated me. And of course, when I was younger, you're always like drawn to those. You hear about stories, this boy was raised by wolves, or, you know, I love Tarzan, you know, raised by, you know, apes and gorillas. It was just really something that I always enjoyed. And so fast forward, what I really kind of really got an idea about some of this is when I read my late friend Rob Riggs' book, about Into the Big Thicket, which is the Big Thicket is an area here in Texas that's yep. got a notable history of not only paranormal activity, but just a long history of being a rugged environment. It's swampy, it's wooded, hard to penetrate. And the people who live there, were amazing who were able to live in this environment. But in that book, right there, just sort of almost in passing, Rob mentions that some people had reported to him seeing what they believed were like a primitive tribe, members of what literally sounded like Native Americans. And you know, not just in terms of like you hear that kind of a ghost stories, you know, people see Confederate soldiers or they see Native Americans. But this was almost like these were real. And one of those, a power lineman was working on the line and some of these primitive looking people emerged out of the woods and actually shot an arrow at him. And wow. Just thinking, of course, your mind goes, when you're a Texan, we have tribes that once lived here, the Karankawas and the Atakapas, that were alleged to be very dangerous. The Karankawas were said to be like cannibalistic. They were, you know, these guys were 7 feet tall. They were just a very ominous tribe. And though that tribe just sort of disappeared, these weren't tribes that were just, herded off to Oklahoma to be on reservations. They disappeared. Now that could be legit, but your mind then jumps to wonder if some of them survived, went into the big thicket, and have been there all along. It seems, you know, implausible, but not totally impossible. And so that's where my mind really got to spin. And also Chester, he's done a lot of stuff in Big Thicket. We begin to discuss that. And that's what set us on this path.
Well, and, you know, when you start looking at, once again, that area, number one, as most people know, Texas is vast. It's large. It's really, really big. And once you get into unpopulated areas of Texas, it can be miles before you have a neighbor. You know, much less once you get to the extreme expanses of wilderness that make up the Big Thicket. There are parts of the Big Thicket, much like in southeast Oklahoma, stuff like that. The area that's right there in that area that touches Texas, where you can't see 5 feet in front of your face inside of the woods. It's so dense.
Right. Yeah. The Big Thicket. I mean, it is what its name sounds like. And it's a unique ecology because when glaciers, you know, thousands of years ago were coming south and pushing seeds and plants and acorns and all manner of flora, it sort of converged there in that area that's known as the Big Thicket. So it's sort of a crossroads of all these different ecological environments. You'll see plants that you don't see anywhere else located there. And, you know, you can go from what looks like there's palmettos and it's very swampy to something that looks very much like a thick pine forest. So you have all of that in this environment, which creates a unique place, you know, different, all kinds of different flowers. So, and it's because it's kind of rugged and swampy and thick, you know, it's not been developed. You know, people have lived in there and these people are rugged folks. I mean, they worked in logging or they raised, you know, livestock, hogs or whatever. And it's interesting to read about their lives. But it is definitely a place that still, as much as it can, holds on to some of that primitive wild wilderness. And that all kind of plays into the piney woods of East Texas. So you're right. It's just one of those places that if there was ever a place where, you know, a Texas Bigfoot or a primitive tribe would hide, literally the Big Thicket would be it.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And once again, you're at Texas Bigfoot Conference every year. There's a reason why Jefferson, Texas is the Bigfoot capital of Texas. It's right there in the middle of all that. There are tons of sightings in that area every year, and that does bring to bear the idea of that was a description for a long time was wild man. Even for Yowie, things like that, that was one of the descriptions was that it was a wild man that lived in the woods.
Right, and that's where it becomes fascinating to kind of conjecture whether they were talking about Bigfoot or at some point, you know, you probably did have a lot of more feral people. I mean, you know, people, if you went homeless, you were feral, and you know, I have some cases. I kind of just compile some of this over the years. So I may not be working on a project about that, but when I see something interesting, I'll file it in the catalog. Yep. Or if somebody tells me a story or whatever, I may interview them or collect newspaper articles. But over the years, there's been some really cool cases of people, you know, back in the early 1900s, like hunters and things would report seeing what they would describe as a wild man or a wild woman in the woods. And, you know, there would be multiple sightings. It wasn't just like one guy said he saw somebody running through the woods. It would be like over and over, and it would build this case where someone or something was living in these wooded areas. And this has been in various spots in the Piney Woods, not just the Big Thicket. But, you know, with the Big Thicket, again, Rob Riggs, he was a school teacher and a journalist who lived in Saratoga area, down there by the Big Thicket. And he would field these reports, and people who didn't even know each other were kind of feeding into him building a case where these primitive humans. And in one case, you know, a guy said that there was a prospector who was prospecting in the area north of Trinity Bay, which is on the kind of the south end of the Big Thicket. The Trinity Bay comes up from the Gulf, and all that's a wild area. And this prospector was out there, and he said that a game warden kind of warned him to, if he was going to go further into the thicket, to be armed, because some hunters had been in there and they had been shot at by these primitive humans and actually had an arrow.
Whoa.
And the crazy thing about this is Chester was talking about this on his Dark Outdoors podcast, and a guy called in and said, my dad worked for the police department and he saw the arrow, and he said, I saw a picture of it. This was a real thing. This wasn't just hearsay or anecdotal. So we began to build up this case beyond what Rob Riggs had done, to where, okay, this happened. There was some primitive looking tribesmen in there shooting arrows. They presumably didn't hit anybody, although people have gone missing down there, so you never really know. But
yeah,
so that's kind of what Chester and I began to assemble some more stuff, and even more recent reports where we could interview somebody that had a sighting. So we're putting together a documentary on this. This is how this stuff works. You're fascinated 1 minute, and the next minute you're doing a documentary. But we have a filmmaker buddy that works with Chester. He came down, and we went down to the Trinity Bay. We went into the Big Thicket, and we went doing some exploring down there. And even when we were by boat into the Trinity River, I kid you not, we got out on this remote sort of almost like an island, but it was connected, but it was way out there. And within not even 5 minutes, the filmmaker finds a bare human track. Not a Bigfoot track, but a human track. Barefooted. And there is no way I'd go barefooted in here. I mean, it wasn't just like on the bank. It was way up in the woods.
Wow.
And we're like, dude, what are the chances we find a human footprint out here? Not to say that's a feral person or not, but I mean, it was like, okay.
and just a stray print, just one.
You could see where there's probably two or three. There was a one where you could really tell, but
okay.
And then it was sort of in the sloshy mud because there's a lot of reed grass in there and stuff off that shore, and it was up in the woods. And so it was almost like at the edge of a marsh where it kind of goes down. So the footprints were subject to being in that sloshy water. So sure. There was only one sort of that was off the grass in the mud before it got into the really damp mud where you could see there was a footprint. Beyond that, but it wouldn't registering. But we at least got that one. And then just freaky. So
that is freaky. You know,
and of course, as you probably know, the Big Thicket is also the area where Bragg Road is. And Bragg Road is a very notable place where people have seen, alleged ghost lights or spook lights, as they call them. And myself and our mutual friend Glenn Haskins actually saw those lights down there several years ago ourselves. And so this is just a paranormal hotspot. And not only has it got sightings of a Bigfoot creature called Old Mossyback, which I talk about in my Texas Bigfoot book, but you got the Ghostlight Road, and now you've got wild men shooting arrows at people. It's like you can't ask for a better place.
That is absolutely wild that you guys have tracked down somebody whose family was in the police department, had seen a picture of the arrow, and have gotten this far with this case already, Lyle. That's absolutely wild. And I mean, of course, I post a lot of stuff on our group regularly about I typically tag you or King Gerhard or even Chester whenever I see such things. But there's been a huge uptick lately in bear sightings in East Texas. Those are hugely up right now, like great numbers again. So, of course, there's that when it comes to Bigfoot and stuff like that. And frequently it's the case that, sure, a bear track may resemble a Bigfoot track, something like that, especially a double step, but you aren't mistaking a human footprint for a bear footprint, you know? And once again, for this bear human footprint to be out that far is fascinating, because anybody out that far, if they are wildlifing or something like that, or even out squatching, would probably have boots on. They would not be walking around barefoot in such environs. You know, the average person does not do that.
No, it would be ill-advised. I mean, there's a lot of thorns and, you know, ground hazards. And then, I mean, this is Texas. We got all manner of snakes and so forth. Yeah. I don't go anywhere without my snake boots, especially down there anywhere near the Big Thicket. So
yeah.
I it was just odd. And it, you know, it just fuels that fire on what we're already doing. You know, here we are working on a documentary. So that was pretty cool. And I'm, you know, we were able to take a boat down there deep into the Trinity Bay and just kind of get out and explore. And then we drove up into the Big Thicket and did some, you know, expedition there, not necessarily expecting to, you know, get shot by an arrow, but you know, that would have made good documentary material, but just to get that feel for, you know, what is this environment? Is this even possible? I mean, people obviously live there. There's game wardens. There's been, over the years, probably since about 1940, the area of the Big Thicket has suffered, you know, a lot of logging and a lot of encroachment. So prior to that, it would have been pretty easy to live back in there. But once you got past 1940, especially from early 1960s on, and what we're talking about in these reports would have been, I believe, in like the 1980s or so, where people were supposedly getting shot at. So it's been a number of years, but you know, and it's multiple people. Riggs had multiple people. Chester found a guy who saw something recently. All of that, and you combine that, it makes a fascinating topic to explore.
Well, and you know, once again, Texas is not isolated with this. When you start looking, there are numerous reports of wild men, all kinds of things. And once again, these are normally associated with Bigfoot. The idea that, though, and this is one that I shared with you guys a couple years ago whenever it hit the wires, was the Wolfman that was spotted in the German mountains like actual picture taken of this guy. And yeah, when you look at it, it looks like the prototypical caveman. Huge stick, at least the size of him, body fully covered in hair, all kinds of things. So when you start looking at stories like this, you can find that, folks. Feel free to just Google mysterious naked wolfman spotted in German mountains, and you'll see it from not only Telegraph UK, but New York Post. There are numerous sources for that story. So when you start looking at that, there's, once again, not just in the US, but the world over, seems like there may be pockets of unfound civilization. You know, it's pretty regularly found, like there was just a new undocumented tribe found in the Amazon not too long ago, like within the last few months, reported. So the idea that there are native pockets of humanity that have totally escaped modern technology, modern environs, things like that, I'm prone to believe that there may be at least a few here and there.
Yeah, there was a case, and I cannot remember the year offhand. It's been a number of years since I looked at this, but in the Pacific Northwest, there was a case, and you may be able to find it. It was a actual tribesman. I don't remember what tribe, but he came out of the woods, and this was a full-on, you know, native that had once been, you know, living up there with a tribe who just went feral, so to speak, or living off the land alone. And he came out of the, it might have been in the 80s, I can't remember, but that, I mean, that was a verifiable case, and he had been living out there for a long time. And of course, the Pacific Northwest is another place where, you know, there's vast amounts of forestry that could easily hide anything. So
yeah,
there's definitely those cases. And of course, we all know the Amazon has been, you know, ground zero for finding complete villages of people nobody knew existed, you know, back in there. So, you know, and those cases are fascinating. Just when you think about it in terms of, we're so used to our modern life, you know, we go to cities, you and I travel all over, you know, the place, going to different, you think, oh, you take that for granted. But to imagine that some people on our earth are living completely oblivious to that. You know, and so that's a pretty cool concept. And you're right, the wild man is just, it's almost like when if I do Bigfoot research anywhere and you start kind of zeroing in on an area, you can go backwards from there, and people will have reported what they called wild men.
Yep.
You know, because the term Bigfoot wasn't coined until 1958.
Yeah.
Prior to that, people thought of them as Yetis, because the Yeti was more famous since the late 1800s, early 1900s. But there was no concept of Bigfoot, especially, like, you know, there's stories in Arkansas where, you know, hunting parties would come across wild men. Well, even if they were described as hair covered or upright or tall or big, the term Bigfoot wasn't something they used. So they were always called wild men. And certainly, I think some of those could have been people running into Bigfoot and not having a term for it, but also there's people that just simply lived off the land and lived in the woods, and they were legit wild people.
Well, and you know, that's kind of where I come down with it, man. Like, you know me, I am Cajun by background, at least 50%. I know a few of my relatives who could definitely go out bayou side and probably be by themselves for the rest of their life, and they'd be all right. They'd be able to trot line, they'd be able to trap, and other than maybe leaving a trace behind here and there, you'd be lucky to ever find them, you know? And when you start looking at things, like, this is something that I bring up pretty regularly, and yeah, it's a few years old, but it's an image from the ISS of the United States at night. And when you bring that up, there's a lot of black in there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of area where there ain't nothing. you know? And when you start overlaying that with like beef row and sightings and stuff like that, like in here in just a second, I'll bring up the beef row map and we can A-B them. But when you do that, like if it's like you've overlaid them on top of each other. It's very interesting to see like those sightings of Bigfoot and other critters, right there where there aren't any city lights. You know, we have this concept of America as a fully settled metropolis. And it's not. There's a lot of Texas. There's a lot of this state and other states that are just nothing. Right now, yeah, they're undeveloped.
I had a conversation the other day with somebody about that whole concept of people think that Texas is just some sort of ranch land, scrub land, barren sort of, yeah, you know, cowboy landscape. People don't realize that the eastern third with the piney woods that we have thick forestry and even swamps. I mean, yeah, people kind of forget we, our neighbor is Louisiana, the Bayou state. Well, yep, it doesn't just start at the border. I mean, it gets really swampy and thick, and you can go into those places. You know, you can take aerial photographs, and if you drop somebody in there with no GPS or compass, you'll quickly find that, it's hard to find your way out. And, there is a portion of land that still looks just like it did when settlers began to come here, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's just it. There is a large population, or large part of the United States without population, without people there. You know, we still have quite a bit set aside in the United States that is unsettled, and kind of unsettled on purpose. But once again, when you start looking at those maps, it's one of those that it's very interesting to see that we have so much dead space,
right?
And so much space that there are spots in the Pacific Northwest where they lose a few planes a year. Many of them are never found, and those things have transponders. That is a full on rainforest in the Pacific Northwest, and parts of it that are fully inaccessible by us. So if there are tribes of people that have been living, guaranteed they can keep on living.
That's right. That's probably where D.B. Cooper is. He's just living with a nice tribe somewhere.
Yeah, right.
In the Pacific Northwest. But even that's when I was doing my Sinister Swamps book, I was fascinated to learn that in the Okefenokee Swamp, which is located in southern Georgia, the same kind of thing. Planes have gone down out there that they never could find.
Yeah.
Or they'll come across like a plane that's just got exposed above the water, and some fisherman or whatever, alligator hunter says, oh, I've just found a plane.
Like, Flight 17 is a prime example. That wasn't just one plane. That was numerous planes, and those were trained pilots. Mm-hmm. The last heading they had was headed toward the swamps, and they have never been found, and that was a squadron of fighters. That was a few, you know? It's funny how, once again, the misconceptions that we have because of the world that we live in. And when you start looking at that, there is a large part of the world. And it's something that I've brought up even when it comes to Bigfoot structures, things like that, is what if it's actually a tribe or someone like that who is nomadic and moving around and moving from place to place, leaving a scant amount of things so that if they come back, hey, all they have to do is throw their animal skin up and their tarp is made, you know. But if they're out roaming and hunting and doing that, then yeah, they would probably, much like any previous Native American society, have small encampments that they go back and revisit annually as they follow the game around from season to season.
Right. And we need those necessities. And, you know, I think when you, another place where this topic is pertinent is where we talk about the Great Smoky Mountains and the Appalachian Trail and all this whole idea that there's quote wild people or feral people that live off in there in the national forest. And that's, you know, been the source of conjecture from when you kind of intersect the world of Bigfoot with missing persons, and you have an area where literally the hairy, scary, wild man tradition in Tennessee, the creature is called the Tennessee Wild Man, which I think is interesting. And it's said to be a Bigfoot, but it's literally called the Wild Man. And that's where you have this area with the Great Smoky Mountains, where people have seen what they believed are primitive humans living in there. And then, you know, with all various disappearances, which you're going to have when you have dense forestry and you have people hiking through there, that some of those people are not experienced, or you have kids. But when people go missing, well, and that's an area where you have sightings of primitive humans, people start to put two and two together. So that's definitely a place where you could focus. I mean, Chester and I could focus in on that even as a documentary subject if you wanted to go another route on the feral human / wild man topic, because that's a hot one.
Well, and you know, there was a very interesting case that I want to say came out of Tennessee. Hold on, let me find it. 8-year-old girl stays with bear, normally brings it up. But there was a case of a girl all of a few years ago, where it was a boy, where a boy actively stayed with a bear, like got lost in the woods, and Maggie Simpson style was taken care of by a bear for days. Now, whether that bear, and let's just ponder this for a moment, folks, would a bear take in a human child in such a way? You know, I don't know, but it'd be pretty tough for that kid to get away from a bear.
Yeah, the bear, it's like, and, you know, I've observed, we have a cabin in the mountains in northern New Mexico, so I observe actual bears in the wild quite a bit, and it's just hard to imagine that a bear would take in a human. Now, I could see a great ape doing that, you know, possibly a chimpanzee or a gorilla. Yeah, you can kind of see that happening. A bear, I don't know. They just seem so.
And there it is. Casey Hathaway. Casey Hathaway was the boy who said a bear kept him company.
Right.
No, and of course, nobody can prove it didn't happen, but this was days. Days they were looking for this child who disappeared in the woods behind his house. And I have posited for a while one of two options. A, either a Sasquatch took care of him, or B, maybe somebody in a bear skin, or in what an 8-year-old would equate to be a bear. You know?
Yeah, true.
Sans any wild frame of reference. I mean, of course, I think probably more than any animal, children are more familiar with bears than anything, most of them having had a stuffed bear somewhere around them in life. However, that is a wild tale, like, even for an 8-year-old. And I taught 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds for like a decade of my life. That is a tall tale for a kid to come up with, to say, I was lost for days and didn't come back like emaciated, didn't come back in ill health in any way, shape, or form. So obviously, like, cared for, fed, watered during this time, you know? So yeah, just wild that the boy says that a bear took care of him. So once again, the idea of an 8-year-old being picked up by the nape of the neck, like Maggie Simpson, and taken off to a bear cave. I don't know about that, but the idea of something else taking care of him and being able to express that. I think Bear may be as close as the kid might have been able to come.
Yeah, and that's not the only case. If you, you know, read some of course, this ties in with David Pilates' 411 books, where he describes a lot of these missing persons cases, that there's several of them where the kid, you know, is lost and they find him and they say, oh, well, a nice bear took care of me.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so we got a lot of Goldilocks and the three bear things going on, you know, but, and of course he's really struck a gold mine there with these kind of cases, because you really, there's no way to really prove or disprove any of them. When people go missing, you only have the information that you have. And some of these cases are old, and certainly I've grown up hunting and been an outdoorsman all my life. And I'll tell you, before we had cell phones, my dad did not carry a GPS. He did not have compass. We didn't even carry water. We just, it was just like, there was no thought.
Landmarks and dead reckoning.
Yeah, we got lost several times. And when I was a kid, I mean, it scared me. My dad seemed calm, but I mean, we got lost and it was not hard. And my dad he's been hunting all his life as well, but I'm a little more pragmatic and smart about things. If I'm going out, and of course, we have modern conveniences now.
Sure.
And your cell phone almost has coverage everywhere. But prior to that, I would have a compass and some idea where I was going. But point being is people do legit go missing. But
absolutely,
you do have that portion of cases where there's just some strange thing going on about it. And certainly, if you have a child saying he was taken in by a bear, your mind starts to conjecture. Is like, really?
Well, and especially when you start talking about, once again, Tennessee, like where the wild man is supposed to live, you know, things like that. And a great bear landscape, don't get me wrong, but I don't know about a bear taking in a human child in such a way. And it happens. Don't get me wrong. There are definitely cases of feral children being found across the globe. There was the famed feral child in the Ukraine that was found that I want to say she was like 10 years old or 11 years old when found, not malnutritioned or anything, but living with a pack of wolves. And had been adopted by a pack of wolves at a young age and lost all capacity for speech. Things like that. So there are definite cases of children being taken in by animals.
There was a cool, I don't know if you ever saw that series. There was like a TV series, probably like, I was at least 10 years ago. And it was feral children. And I was only about 5 episodes, but they covered that one.
Yeah.
It was a really cool show. But I mean, it was literally like 5 episodes. I don't remember the name of it, but it's a really cool show. If people can find that and you're interested in this topic, that'd be one to watch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, David Pilates, it's interesting that you bring him up because, his work with Missing 411, I had a chance to meet him and talk for a little while at the MUFON conference. He was there in Ohio a couple years ago presenting on the very, very wild interest that UFOs have with some of these missing cases, and specifically with the cases that happened in and around cases of animal mutilation near livestock farms across the country. And it was fascinating because, once again, he popped up a map of the U.S. and was like, here's our food production facilities for this stuff, and here's where these sightings and instances are happening. Why are they so interested in the food chain? Really fascinating stuff. But when he starts getting into the way in which scent dogs, and that's an interesting one, the fact that dogs on the case completely lose scent or come to a point where they no longer want to be near what's happening, one of the two, where they are on trail, they're on good scent, and the handler is even like, my bloodhound's right on it. And then it's suddenly like they hit a wall and all trail stops. And it's, yeah, it's fascinating to see that, because there are numerous cases like that where scent trails stop. That kind of stuff just ends.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that therein conjecture reigns supreme when you have all those combinations of strangeness that may converge. I mean, and again, you have UFOs and Bigfoot, everything else that come to play in at least a few of these cases. I mean, like, sure, I said, I'm sure it, when you get down to it, people get lost, but then there's just strange aspects to it. And it's fascinating. And, you know, it's almost like unsolved mysteries that you can never quite prove, because there's no way to find out any more about it than what was in the paper or what's in the police file or whatever's documented, you know. And, but yeah, I mean, there's strange things in this world you just can't explain. And, or there's, I think that's a, that's a lyric from a Charlie Daniels song. There's things in this world you just can't explain.
That's right.
Well, Charlie was right.
That was Woolly Swamp.
Yeah, Legend of Woolly Swamp. I love that song. You know, I love swamp stuff.
But when you start looking at these things, once again, there are the legends of the Cherokee Little People. That goes beyond Bigfoot, stuff like that, where you're talking about small humanoids running around in the woods, helping people out, things like that. So,
and I find all those fascinating. They're almost like tangents of cryptozoology in a way. It's like I really find all that kind of stuff really fascinating. I mean, you know, I love Bigfoot stuff and everything, but the, you know, your sightings ad nauseum, but there's these things like that with little people, puckwudgies, feral people, all these sort of tangent topics that just fall into that big umbrella of the unexplained. I just love all those things. And just the weird stuff, you know, I just love it.
Well, and once again, the idea of a wild man being in the woods of America, I do not doubt it one bit when it comes to a feral human being, when it comes to a lost tribe, anything like that. There are a certain regimen of people in the world who want nothing at all to do with modern society. There have always been those people. There have always been, I mean, heck, you look at it in a biblical sense, that was John the Baptist. You know, he was a man that lived out in the wild and had honey and locusts in his beard and everything else. He lived in the wilderness, quite literally. And most people would look at him and be like, whoa, that's a little much coming into the city there, Joe, you know? So yeah. The idea of that existing throughout humanity, the idea of that being carried into modern society, and even having people who live on the adjunct, or B, a tribe that has just never been brought into the fold, even if it's a small family circle that lives outside of things. I think there's plenty of room for that in the big thicket.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a cool place. And I always love going down there. My dad's family is from East Texas. So for a while there, I grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth. I didn't realize, like many people, that there was such places. And when we went out to East, I remember once going through the Big Thicket area, and I was like, wow, this looks really cool. I mean, I just thought it was just appealing to me. And then just to find out that it has so many mysteries that we're still unraveling, you know, everything that Rob Riggs had done. And I really recommend his book that he showed. That's definitely a cool book. And then, Rob was he had some wild theories, and he did a lot of legwork to document a lot of stuff that would have literally been lost, because what he was working on early on was there was no internet to pass things around. He was getting this from people who actually lived in the area. So there's some stuff that he recorded that would have otherwise been lost in time. So I think, you know, Chester and I are just picking up the ball there with something that was just sort of a passing mention in that book, and then fully exploring it. And then by offering a documentary, we can sort of bring it from his book and take it further. And that's been really exciting for us because we both, you know, knew Rob, and yeah. It's really fun to kind of take that. And it's funny because I was a story producer for the television show Monsters and Mysteries in America, and I was always trying to sell them on doing this. I was like, dude, there'd be people getting shot at by
arrows,
tribes. But they kind of needed a first-person witness, and a lot of this was secondhand or it was old. And so I could get it, but I did try to sell them. I was like, but now it's cool because we actually have the means to do it ourselves. That was years ago when you couldn't, a little harder to do documentaries or if you wanted to do them yourself. But now we're able to do that. So it's been a fun project, and I can't really wait. I can't wait to see the end product because you know, we do our part, and then it goes on to the filmmaker, Paul. And so I should say that we're actually going to debut this at the Texas Bigfoot Conference.
Oh, fantastic. That's great.
And that's October 17th and 18th in Jefferson, Texas. So I think as it goes on the Saturday night or Friday night. Friday or Saturday night?
I think it might be Saturday.
That we are going to just show it. It's not a really long movie. You know, it encompasses what it needs to. So it's not super long, but it's either Friday or Saturday night. I think Greg was working out those details, but yeah, we're going to debut that. So if you're there,
special,
you can actually see it.
Friday night.
Right.
So,
so that'll be a cool thing, and we'll be excited. I mean, that'll probably be close to the first time I see it as well. So, and what I can't wait for is apparently they've done some reenactments with natives, dressing a guy up, like, and putting him, and this was going on in the summer, like, okay, hey, you got to go out in the woods, like, pretty much half naked, and don't worry about mosquitoes or snakes. This is all for documentary purposes. So it'll be cool to see what they've done. So,
well, honestly, if you're going out that deep in the woods in the middle of summer in Texas, you might ought to be about half naked, because it's going to be Dickens hot for you out in the middle of all that.
Oh, dude, I you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be Tarzan, and same. Because my dad hunted, we were always on this hunting lease out in, he had a hunting lease in Possum Kingdom.
Oh, okay.
Which is west of Fort Worth out there. I would always be in a tree, and I'd carry a knife, you know. I had a cool hunting knife, and I would never have a shirt on. Somehow I don't recall, like, ever getting ate up by mosquitoes, but chiggers was the worst.
Yeah, no, I used to go to a camp here just outside of Austin. Chiggers were absolutely awful. I don't remember mosquitoes being the way that they are now. When I was a kid, maybe they just didn't bother me as much. Like, I see my 8-year-old and it's like, my God, I wish I could spend that much time outside now. At 50, I'm like a snow cone. just immediately, I know, that begin heat, melting.
The elements are really, so you think about them more, but when you're a kid, you don't think about any of that. You're just like, hey, I'm trying to be Tarzan. A weather forecast is not something I'm interested in. I don't care about bugs. I literally am trying to be Tarzan here, and my mom's trying to get me out of the tree to eat a sandwich. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny because when you get out there with things like this, it is like being a kid again. You get excited, you get enthralled, you get brought into a story like that when you were investigating it, Lyle. So I want to thank you and Chester for chasing this story down, because I think it's really a cool story, B, something that we need to consider. You know, as I say all the time, if you like Sasquatching, if you like Bigfoot, things like that, get into conservancy, man. Get into protecting their habitat, that kind of stuff. And even when it comes to this, if there is a small cadre of Native Americans living in the woods between Texas and Louisiana, then we need to do what we can to protect and preserve them in the way that they are. No different than the loggers move around the tribes of the Amazon that have been there, you know, or should be anyway, if they aren't. Because that's how we keep them undisturbed. That's how we keep a culture alive and real. So, yeah, I think it's great that you guys are chasing this story down, because much like the one I bring up pretty regularly here on the show in Germany, it's interesting to see that there may be something out there, that there may be a pocket of humanity that is still surviving, and one that is untouched by our modern systems, untouched by our modern technology. So good for them. I say we keep it that way, and we try and preserve them and what they are and what they're about as much as possible.
Yeah, I think that you almost want that. You want some of that primitiveness to still exist, even if it's just a small amount or just a few people. You know, it's like maybe they're actually better off. You know, these tribes and people go in there and try to tell them what to do, or give them religion or whatever. It's like, you know what? They maybe just have been the happiest people on earth, because you go in the city and there's a lot of disgruntled people. It's like, I'm not sure our way is the best way. So it's almost cool to preserve some of that, the primitive quality on earth that has been here and has really been the way for millions of years, you know, in terms of the age of the earth and the life that's been on here, and however many years that humans have been a part of it. And that's, of course, debatable, but just to preserve that primitiveness and that mystery that goes along with it is something that I really love.
Absolutely. Same here. It's one of those, we, even as we grow up, Lyle, we have to maintain our childlike sense of wonder with things, and we have to be willing to be awed by stuff. And once again, the fact of there may be something out there like that keeps me in awe. The fact that somebody has the resilience to be able to live that lifestyle still is amazing and fantastic to me. So I hope you guys do come across something in your travels, in your investigation. Congratulations on the new documentary. It's absolutely awesome that you guys did this. So thanks a lot for taking the time, bud. Before we let you go, let everybody know upcoming appearances, books, all that kind of stuff. Where can everybody find you? Where can everybody keep track of everything that is Lyle Blackburn?
Well, my website, lyleblackburn.com, has a good list of everything that I've done as far as books, film stuff, and it's got a list of all the appearances. It seems like October is going to be busy. I'll be at the Honeybee Bigfoot Conference the first weekend in October. And then the Texas Bigfoot Conference is 17th and 18th. And then I'll be at the Arkansas Paranormal Expo. I think that's the 25th. And so, yeah, a lot of cool events coming up. And I'm looking forward also to getting out and doing a little field research as well once it starts cooling off, because, you know, it's gotten off. It's usually hot and a lot of insects. So I once it turns fall, then I get out in the field and get out and do some of these events. So check LyleBlackburn.com. It's got all the info you need.
All right. Well, Lyle, thanks as always for coming on, bud. I greatly appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out all of the amazing events, as well as books, films, everything from Lyle Blackburn over at LyleBlackburn.com. Everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can find all of not only our episodes, but also our social media. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share, That is where you can find our events page full of all of the events that we go out and cover every year, including things like the 9/11 conference that we are actively at right now. So stay tuned next week for our coverage from that, everybody. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, Daniel Allen Jones.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Also, thank you so much to our friends at True Hemp Science. If you are a fan of CBD products like I am, get them while you can here in Texas, folks. CBD band just like skated, so it's still available. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. True Hemp Science makes some amazing CBD products, folks. I have been using them for almost 6 years now, and their spigeric process uses every part of the plant. Then those parts are used, reused, combusted and reused. Every part of the plant is used, from the seeds, stems, buds, leaves, roots. Every part is used, combusted and reused until a awesome spigeric product is the result, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two free edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Daniel Allen Jones. He is a researcher extraordinaire when it comes to everything UFO, cryptozoology, paranormal. He has been in the field for years and years. He was a research associate with the late, great Jim Mars. We are here talking with him tonight about his continued work in ethnography when it comes to these topics. Now, that is a big word, Daniel, and you know we're down with the $12 words here on this show. but not a lot of people understand what ethnography is. Before we get really down deep and dirty and put our hip boots on, bud, A, welcome back to the show. B, let's get into ethnography to begin with and what ethnography is.
Yeah, hey, Chris, great to be back as always. Appreciate you taking the time to do everything you do for the show and events, media coverage and beyond. There's a lot that goes into it. And most people just see the final product. And now there's so much behind the scenes that goes into it all. So
thanks for that.
Appreciate the continued appearances that I've been able to share with you here. And you're right. I think that when it comes to researching, studying, looking into, exploring any of these strange topics that are usually on the fringes of society, it's hard to really get a good sense of how to navigate what's going on with the concepts espoused, with the ideas that people talk about, and what direction it's all headed in, whether it's about UFOs, whether it's about strange encounters with unknown creatures, whether it's some kind of metaphysical concept or parapsychology. And so when it comes to ethnography, same thing for myself. I didn't really know what this was or how to really go about making sense of what I was doing in a lot of these different fields, not just fields of study, but groups of people, the communities involved with these subjects as a subculture. I found eventually over a decade of my own time, really investing myself into these communities, that there is a way that I found to make productive my efforts, my involvement and my investments in not just looking into cases and research topics, but the groups of people and the organizations and individuals and different things like this involved are sort of a ragtag, you know, loosely tattered culture or just subculture. Mm. And for someone who spends time in a culture, you know, there's a lot of ways that someone could go about doing this, but in anthropology, when you have someone, an anthropologist, go in and really take the time to immerse themselves into a group of people to study it, and it, you don't even necessarily have to be a degreed anthropologist. I'm certainly not. I'm just an amateur. And so I find that, you know, anyone can go and do any of these things, but how you make it into something coherent and producible, I think is up to the person involved. In my case, I found that along the way, I was able to articulate what I've been doing for years into what you just mentioned, ethnographic work, which is essentially a cultural study. So I always like to tell people, whether it's in person, online, through podcasts like this or at events, is that as fascinated as I am with the different phenomena, all these different topics, I'm equally as interested in the groups of people who are involved with them. That's right. So ultimately, I think that it's important to look at all of those different subjects and topics, but also the reason why we look at it as a culture or in society, the reasons why we look at these things the way we do is basically through these various cultural lenses. And I think it's important to also get a sense, when I was really first interested in checking any of this out, it wasn't through a direct experience necessarily, where a lot of people, they might see a UFO or they might have an encounter or they experience something. And I've had various experiences, and I think that, you know, most people do. And in some way, that brings us to seek what's going on by connecting with other people. And in my case, I just like to say I wanted to find like-minded others to see who else is into this stuff. So, you know, in my own life, you know, in about 2010, I took it upon myself. At this point, I had amassed a small library of literature about these things, and whether it was UFOs, cryptids, anything metaphysical and parapsychology, and a lot of other stuff as well, other alternative topics. I think that it helped me to see that they're not really only research topics, that there are active groups and people and individuals who are working towards having something such as a model through which we can better understand what we can do to explore these things and do what we can scientifically and socially to have a better understanding or a better model to describe experiences and what is being reported all over the world. And so what that really brought me to is a way to try to better articulate not just my own involvement, but to see that I had already been spending time in many of these different groups since 2010. And through that, I've connected with many individuals, not just interviewing other researchers, but self-proclaimed witnesses, those who describe experiences in a firsthand accounts, and also those who are involved with organizations. I have also been involved with those same organizations. Yeah. So I found that I was doing those things. I was getting involved. I was immersing myself in these communities. And I also say this not to try to set myself apart as if I'm not connected with those things or people or anything, because I ultimately am. And in some way, I just think that it's important to see that, you know, you can have an objective viewpoint in a way that's set aside from, you know, belief or rigid structure of an outlook that has to be a certain way. And I think that it's okay to be open-minded, but not also so much that you just believe everything. So I found that, you know, in many ways, there are a lot of people doing this kind of work. You yourself have done a great deal of ethnographic work simply just through this format of having various guests on, many of our colleagues and good friends who share their research, their information, people who share their accounts of experiences. And you're not only cataloging and archiving it, but you're providing it for the public. And I think that's the other big component, is that anyone can do any of this stuff and go out of their way and be involved. It's what you do, I think, to make use of that time. And that's where I found I really wanted to find that my involvement has been productive through producing it as a tangible work. And so what I've been working on for a few years now is trying to compile the entirety of my involvement up to this point in literary form, but also in digital form that can be provided for. And in some way, I have done a lot of that with the media work through like my platform, the Vortex. But I think it's mainly something that isn't really just about sharing information, but it's about providing something for people to understand that there are so many ways in which these different types of phenomena are perceived. There's not one outlook. And I think it's important to also underline really that many people involved get involved because of a curious situation and experience that brings them into these groups and these communities or events. And as you know, there can be a lot of camaraderie, but at the same time, it's sort of a double-edged sword because there's a lot of infighting and there's also a lot of stratification and fraternization. So in short, I think that there's something to be said about how these communities operate, the ways in which they communicate, the models they use in which they attempt to understand the nature of reality in accordance with what they describe as what seems to be a very real phenomena to many people, and in some way a very false and fake phenomena to many other people. So I think it's really about understanding the outlook rather than only the described phenomena on its own. That really helps us give us a sense of cultural relevance. And that's where I think the ethnographic work that I've been doing, when I refer to ufology ethnography or cryptozoology ethnography, or even, beyond that. So in anthropology, again, the ethnography is a cultural study. And in some ways, when you combine cultural studies or compare them, it becomes what we refer to as ethnology. And it may just be semantics to some people, but what I found is throughout these various groups that not only are there parallels and similarities and a lot of crossover, as you know, some people, they really stick to their field, their area of specialty or expertise or whatever anyone wants to refer to it as. But there is a lot of bleed through and crossover and connections between ufology, cryptozoology, and the paranormal as sort of a big blanket statement. So in those connections, I found that it's interesting to see those similarities and the things that aren't similar as a form of ethnology as well, because I also am fascinated with the groups and individuals who are focused on parapsychology, which is itself a huge umbrella term of things like metaphysical concepts and consciousness and that sort of stuff as well.
Well, and, you know, there have been a couple of efforts that I have been behind over the last few years, Daniel, and one of them is, of course, Curious Research. And a lot of Curious Research is preparing the everyday workaday person that goes out squatching on the weekends or paranormal investigating on the weekends to shake hands with science with their data, as well as getting science to get back to a point of remembering that there should be no box to science. That science is never complete. It's forever on the hunt. It's forever changing. Otherwise, my son would have Pluto on his solar system chart in his bedroom. I have it in my high school textbook from astronomy. Like, I still have the teacher's edition that the teacher gave me because it was the last class of astronomy that we had at my high school. She was like, "You've done better than any of my students. Please take this. It has Pluto as a planet." Not a planet anymore, because science changes. You see? And as that happens, as these things happen, we have to be willing to change the way we look at things and understand the fact that the ethnography of this and the ethnographic things going on are part of the phenomenology. That's part of the study of the phenomenon, is to understand even the cultural lens through which somebody sees these things. To understand that, and it's a conversation that we have regularly with Reverend Michael J.S. Carter, you know, the fact that, you don't see a lot of African-American people telling stories about the paranormal. It's not something that is typically done within that culture. Whereas you go to a Latin American culture, and there's stories of brujas and supernatural and paranormal, and that is an everyday topic of conversation, because culturally those things are seen through different eyes, and they're seen through a different stigma, even within that subculture of a major culture. And before the show, I was talking about how my sociology professor went and did his master's thesis on the subculture of the Grateful Dead. And just understanding the fact that within this overarching culture are subcultures, and those subcultures may cross paths, and even friends that we know, researchers that we know, who over the last few years have started giving a little more side eye to the word paranormal when it comes to research, even when it comes to researching things like Sasquatch. A few of the hard aper investigators and researchers I know have at least started saying, well, there seems to be something else out there, So even being opened of mind in that kind of way changes things. And like you said, these communities cross over, these things ripple against each other. And it's really interesting to see that happen and to see how the phenomena moves from one to the other. One of the things that I brought up regularly is Bigfoot and orbs. There didn't used to be a lot of cases of Bigfoot and orbs being seen together, or Bigfoot and portals, but it seems over the last decade or so that there have been a lot more, and it may just be cases that are coming out, things like that, and people that are coming forward. But a lot of people coming forward are now talking about portals and cloaking and things like that when it comes, and orbs being present in the presence of Bigfoot, that kind of stuff. So when you start looking at that kind of, once again, ethnographic crossover in that crossover of belief, you have to start looking at the way we believe things, why we believe things. That kind of stuff, even as a culture or subculture, why we believe things.
Yeah, I do think it's also relevant to where we are historically as well, because you can see that the cultural lens of perception will alter and be modified throughout the ages. And it's something that gives rise to how we not just interact with whatever we perceive as these various types of phenomena, but how we interact with each other. Humanity as a collective, I think, is the important part about why we do study anthropology. And many people hear that word and may not really get a good sense of what it really implies. And it's ultimately just the study of humans. And I think that, when we look at all of these different topics in a way that, we really strive to try to understand the topic. And in some way, we might subtly have a better understanding about ourselves more than the actual topic, because we find that the improvements in science, just as like you described, science is a model that helps us to describe, it's a language that we use in attempts to describe nature and the things that are naturally occurring. And what seems to be unnatural or supernatural or whatever we describe in a way that we can help to reorient our reality so that it can accommodate for these challenges of the old classical scientific models, because science isn't really this rigid thing like you described. It's not a box. We have to really help for our understanding of it to adapt to accommodate for whatever the experience or nature or phenomena is. And I think that the important thing, and what you just mentioned as well, really is a big part about how we understand things, not just at our current place in society, but also where it leads us to going forward, because there are a lot of challenges overall with these subjects in the greater aspect of society that are not really accepted in a way that's widely acknowledged. it's not that, let's say, for instance, the UFO topic is a good example that, you know, many, and I think that the ways in which we approach a lot of this is important. A lot of people really strive to be scientifically minded, to utilize critical thinking, all of that. Awesome, amazing stuff. But we have to also consider that, probably a minority of anyone ever getting involved with any of this stuff will actually do any of that. And that unfortunate reality is, I think, not going to change. And I think that because that's not just this situation with these topics, that's literally just society.
Yeah.
We don't have a society that's really, I think, geared solely on science, engineering, and things. That's a big chunk of things. I think there's a lot of programs in schools. People talk about STEM and all that. Cool. But the main thing is that that isn't the sole focus of our society. And unfortunately, a lot of it's geared towards entertainment. And a big chunk of it is also geared towards the arts. And I'm a product of that. I'm a musician. And that's my background and my schooling.
Yep.
And the minimal amount of time I have with any of that, that's, I think, something that has allowed me to find my footing in this odd world in such a way that I can pursue these other areas of interest. And because of that, I've found that there's no one way or right way or wrong way to go about any of this stuff. It can be perceived as such. And there are a lot of people who are very outspoken. And sure. I think that's fine. I think it's okay when you're in a situation socially that if you become out on the public scene, you're susceptible to scrutiny. I think that's okay. Yeah. I think as a musician, we thrive through criticism. I think often that the case is that, people think that, when it comes to these subjects that, you have either like you said, the true believers in a way that really are the diehard, who really, regardless of whatever the actuality is that they will believe it regardless. And I think that is an extremity. I'm just pointing out an extremity. Not everyone is that.
No.
But the other end of things is that, sometimes you have the people who it does not fit within their worldview, so it is not accepted as a potential reality at all.
Which is just as extreme. Just
right. And, polar and you have everything extreme. Between. And with those challenges, I think, comes the reality that when I find I approach any of this, I have to remember that I'll wear various hats. I'll put on my, scientific minded hat, and then I'll put on my entertainment hat when I know that, it's something that I think should be noted at this point that the things that reach the most people are not scientific, unfortunately, if that were the case, things would be a lot different. But what does reach a lot of people en masse are TV shows. It's not books. It's not conferences. It's not presentations or lectures. Those, I think, do play a part in the collective momentum of these things. But ultimately, TV shows garner the attentions of millions of viewers, sometimes even radio. And in doing that, you generate interest. You generate awareness. It doesn't steer society in a direction that I think is scientifically productive, but I also don't know that it's fair to say that that is the ultimate goal of what the intention is behind those vehicles of motivation. And so I think it's important to, in looking in all of these different groups, whether it's the UFO topic, or dealing with the paranormal as a general blanket sort of, statement subject, I think that it's important to see that most media related to these areas is not intended to be consumed as a scientific rigor of a standard that is made to be is our reality. It's made to be suitable for the least common denominator of society, who's the person who is probably scientifically illiterate, who is more likely to remember the things that are entertaining, enjoyable in that regard. And so I think that you have to find not just a balance in how to deliver and to produce content and information, but you also have to find the ways in which scientific directions of these things become effective.
Absolutely.
Just like the entertaining things become effective in their own way. And so why I bring up that really is just because that there are many people out there who, and I think it's fair to say that they're it's like some of these subjects and the subcultures, it becomes like a circus, because we wonder, where's the ultimate effectiveness of how this delivers us into a more elevated form of society, yeah. knowing that it's supposed to, I think, in some way, help us achieve a greater understanding about something that is beyond us, whether it is alien life, whether it is some kind of non-human form of intelligence that either exists here with us in this world or beyond, or it has something to do with a variety of other
yeah.
physical creatures, or is something non-physical. There's so many different ways that could go and into those respective subjects. But I would just say that it's important, I think, overall to note that when you're dealing with any of these types of subjects that, you know, there are a few hard, concrete, definitive factual basis of knowledge, and because of that, it's very easy for people to enter into the arena to make fantastic claims and not big have to provide statements. Any substance to it, because the effect of presenting it to an otherwise, unfortunately, like naive and gullible crowd yeah. is a lot more of a payoff than trying to produce something tangible. And I think that the effect achieved is one that leaves an impression that I think is more effective sometimes than the unfortunate situation where the reality is that scientifically there's not a lot to work with. And so it yeah. should really make anyone curious. The ways in which we operate as a society are more, I think, in the soft social sciences, but have a lot to do with the hard sciences as well, in the ways of engineering and all of that. It goes hand in hand. And I'm not saying that we really need one or the other more, but I do think it would move us to understand as a society that the ways in which storytelling throughout all the ages up until this point have had an effect on us
yeah.
without any real concrete evidence. But the age of information that we live in now demands it. It basically is incumbent upon us and the hard researchers to help provide that in a way that can say these yeah. are great stories, but there is nothing to it. So take of that what you will, believe it if you want, or here's yeah. why it's something that we have to really examine in a way that provides some reality to it.
Sheds light on it. There are two massive examples of that right now in the UFO UAP community, Daniel. Number one was the article that recently came out from the New York Times saying that black budget programs have used actual stories within the UFO UAP community as a means of cover for decades. Now, that infuriated a lot of people. But it's one of those like, yeah, no, that's a black bag thing, dude. And if there's already a story out there saying that this is happening, why would they not just use it? Why would they not just use it to cover up a technology that they're actively working on right now? Like, you've already made the cover story for them. Why pay somebody to come up with a cover story? You've come up with a perfectly good one that half of society is already buying. You know, so if you've already ethnographically got a good clip of even a 20 percentile, 10 percentile of the communities buying this story, why not just use it as cover for the programs? You know, it makes perfect sense because those stories are only going to grow. Now, the problem that you have is, yes, that sows huge, not kernels, but like whole ears of mistrust corn. When it comes yeah. to your government, when it comes to communities in general. The second one that I've been about on social media for the last week is 3i Atlas. And I know there's a lot out there, folks, believe me, but let's look at one scientific thing real quick. When the Atlas telescopes went online. First one went online in 2015. Mauna Loa went online in 2017. We've seen three. This current comet that we're looking at, folks, is called 3i for a reason, because it's the third interstellar object found by the Atlas Telescope Array. Hence its name, 3i Atlas. So in the last 6 years since this has gone online, well, yeah, about six, we've detected three interstellar objects. Now, guaranteed, there's probably been more than that. The question is, we weren't really looking for them. This is an antenna array and telescope array that is made to search for asteroids that might impact Earth, things that may be Earth-ending cataclysms, that kind of stuff. Now, I love Avi Loeb. Avi, you have an open invite, always. However, I will call this out right now. 1.5. He's at about 1.5 out of his 2 predictions. 1.5 of them are wrong. The first one, like, no signals, nothing like that, just a big old rock floating through space. Kind of seems like that's what this is. The second one is the sphericals on the bottom of the ocean floor, which, sure, still out and about on the testing. But right now we're at about 1.5 of what he said, not really swinging over the plate. So this is prediction number 3, that this is alien technology coming toward Earth. And the issue that you have, and I'll bring up Facebook here for all you viewers out there, let's take a look at all these pictures. Amazing pictures that are really, really, like, impactful. Like, look, this one's with Michio Kaku, and he's warning you of things. Look at this picture. There's a big red arrow pointing at this thing. It's huge. It's massive. Look at the size of this comet. Look, here's one with Elon Musk, very worried, next to this comet. Hey, look, there's Avi. All kinds of things. But when you actively go, and now I'm going to bring up the actual images of this comet. These are the best images that we have to date, posted literally 23 hours before this interview. That's as good as it gets right there. It is a smudge on the screen. You can't see things walking on the surface. You can't see a window on it. You can't see the surface of it. You can't see any of that. None of that. But those are not the videos that you see on social media. Those are not the pictures that you see on social media. And it's really, really hard within the communities to get people to calm down and relax and understand this is only the 3rd interstellar object that we have ever had the opportunity to study. So let's look at it that way right now, not as a state of panic, not as a state of here's an alien object. Yes, it's alien because it doesn't come from us. It doesn't come from this solar system. That's the only reason it's being called alien. Aside from that, there's a lot of space rock that floats by us all the time, folks. But we don't have that kind of technology to get that kind of picture, to get that kind of resolution on a moving object at that distance. We just don't.
Right.
And trying to walk people back from that precipice online and having them understand that, hey, even you as a show host, maybe you should put on your picture that it's AI generated, that this isn't the actual image. Like, you're putting a lot of scientific data with that post, you know, like, hey, yeah, it's spewing off carbon dioxide more than usual, this and that, some strange things going on with the nickel content. Okay, cool. But when you marry that scientific data with an utterly obliterated fake AI image and don't put this is an AI generated image, you're now, like, fully stirring that ethnographic pot of how people believe and why they believe it.
I think that's just it. It's one of the challenges we face in media and pop culture in general. Yeah. And it's not really just relegated to these subjects and the things on the fringe only. But your analogy, I think, is really good. And also, I think it should be likened to that of Avi Loeb's claims to these objects with his standing with Harvard. And I think it's something that makes us wonder how this is acceptable, you know, to anyone who's keeping up with Avi. Dr. Loeb, I think, you know, has made some very bold claims, and it's exciting to think that the possibility of the reality can help to generate some kind of interest and productivity in a positive direction. Yes. But as you just mentioned, with the predictions made and things that happen, sometimes things fall off on the wayside. And one of the things that I found, and it's an example, this is a great segue, I think, in some way to share that I had an opportunity to interview Avi Loeb in a way that I asked him not just about the object that came in.
Yeah, Oumuamua.
Oumuamua was a big deal back in like 2017, and it was all over the news. And same thing, the images and graphics used, not real at all. And the people sharing them also may not have known that and are inadvertently sharing that misinformation. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring up Avi, not to say that, you know, that what he's doing specifically should be, we should be critical of. It's anyone, I think, you know, when you're making it an acclaim, you're setting yourself up for criticism in a way that, claims are challenging to come forward with in this kind of way. Now, one of the things I just wanted to mention was that when I interviewed him, it was right before the Pacific Ocean expedition that was, to look for those metal fragments that became something, of this, a spectacle of the spherules. And I think that one of the important things is that there's a lot that could be gleaned if in the reality that these are all real and authentic and authentic extraterrestrial manufactured technologies is specifically what I'm referring to when I say
yes.
that. Authentic particles of some interstellar object, which, you know, that's fine. But if it's actual intelligently manufactured technology, that's different. That would be amazing. But we have to also realize that even Occam's razor suggests that, like, it's unlikely, maybe that it's not unlikely, but we have to go with what is most likely. Yes. You know, we don't really know exactly because, there, like you said, there hasn't been a lot of progress on these since all that happened. It's kind of been 2 years now, and there's not a lot more, I think, that's been shared. So one thing I would say is that people like Dr. Avi Loeb have they have the accolades. They are associated and a bit tenured with a prestigious university. It's Harvard, you know, and so it makes us wonder, how can someone like this get away, so to speak, with these bold claims and still be associated with one of the most prestigious schools in the world? And I think it's wild to suggest that, you know, it's because of just one or two things, when I think it's ultimately there are a lot of ways in which things like this work. But I would say this is that why I bring up him is also that there are a lot of people from many backgrounds who get involved with this subject of ufology in a way that it's not just people who describe experiences or sightings or have reports of something. And it's not just civilians. It's not just military. It's not just so-called whistleblowers. You have people from every sector of society. And why I think it's important to see people with scientific backgrounds coming into this is that just because someone has a scientific degree, has tenure with a university, makes them any more or less credible. I think it's something we, in some similar way, we give credence to because that's the weight we give it as a society, a societal lens of perception. We seem to think that because people have accolades, they are more credible. And in some way, I think that, yes, that can be the case, and statistically probably is the case. But ultimately, just because you're the chair of astronomy at Harvard means that what you say is the truth. And I think that's one of the challenges is that, and here at the end of the year, this thing could come and go and have nothing of note. and maybe that would be for the better than the opposite, which would be it's headed for impact or something. Well, so it's hard to say right now, but we'll probably have a better idea in the next like month to 2 months, you know?
Yeah. No, precisely. We're going to have a much better idea come October, something like that. Once it gets within the point of receiving any kind of signal or getting a craft near it, even, you know, like we did with the DART mission, landing on an asteroid and taking a sample and coming home, things like that. Like we can get that together in short order now that that's been done. You know, but once again, the idea, and don't get me wrong, I am having shirts made that say, like, make science sexy again, because that's one of the catchphrases of this show is, can we please make science sexy again? Can we make it cool again? But we need to get back to the point of Carl Sagan at some point where great, large claims require, or extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Yeah, you know? The Sagan standard.
And that's just it. It's the idea of, hey, I'm all about a new Magellan. I ask for him all the time. At some point, like in 1519, when he said, give me a fleet of ships, I'm going to go to the horizon and I'm going to keep going. People were like, you're crazy. You're going to fall off the edge of the world, man. Up until 1519, we were still all, and don't get me wrong, there's a cadre of people out there who believe the earth is flat. I'm still curious about the other constellations on the other side that I can't see, that my telescope can't get to.
I think it just shows that there's many groups of people who formulate their own ways to make sense of the world, and in a way that is, we find complacency and being okay and with enough of an understanding so that we can live our lives how we need to. Because if you present something, to someone that complicates their structure of reality, sometimes people can say, wow, I'm open to that. I'm open to, you know, letting that come in, being what it needs to be. Will it really affect them in some way? It's hard to say, but there are those who, if it's too complicated, if it means that they have to do something different, look at things different.
Yeah.
It just it gets filtered out. And I think that it's not just with these subjects. It's just how many people operate in
general.
And one thing I wanted to mention is that you showed some of those pictures. Michio Kaku showed up. I met Michio Kaku about a decade ago, and he at the time was sharing he had just written a book called The Future of Physics, and really interesting stuff. He's a theoretical physicist, so he can also get away with making grandiose claims. It's very fun. He was a spokesperson, I guess may still be the spokesperson for the Science Channel, which again, you know, syndicated network television is not always going to be the rigid scientific things that see in journals. They might borrow from things, but it's also geared towards reaching out again to the least common denominator of the scientific illiterate, or just anybody who can be entertained by flashy great things. And not to just bash on Michio, but I would say that he made the claim at that time. I was fortunate to attend a presentation that he gave about that same book, and he said, you know, people wonder about how we got to the point in engineering that we did. Well, he said, well, it's not because we have a flying saucer in a hangar somewhere. And he jokingly said that. And I think that's okay to jokingly say. But then what's interesting is, you know, at that time, it's not that he was unfamiliar with the UFO topic. He had actually written something for Leslie Kane's book, UFOs, which is interesting. But he later, several years later, whenever the New York Times came out their article about the Pentagon program looking into what they refer to as UAP and all of these UFO related
black budgets, black money, and UFOs.
So he actually came, and many news outlets were wanting him to come on and comment, and he actually would change his tone and say, you know, maybe we need to start looking at this differently. We need to see if there are things that we can do to substantiate and corroborate these otherwise fantastic claims. So I think that he's doing what he can do as a spokesperson for science.
That's right.
Realizing that in many ways it's the public outreach way of trying to make sense of the otherwise very difficult things. And so I'd say that, you know, changing the tune of going from saying like, we don't have a flying saucer in a hangar that we're back engineering, to saying that like, there might be something what all these people are saying at this point. Well, to the point of now, we have these congressional hearings of so-called whistleblowers coming forward to share about all kinds of things that we as the public really don't have any strong way of knowing, because nothing is being presented unless something actually has substance. And a lot of it is some of it is being shown to the public, and then a great deal, or at least some of it, is being discussed behind closed doors in skiffs that is not being made public. So it's hard to say what we as the public are really going to, the impression we will have based upon simple testimony. Yeah. Some of it's very exciting. And again, it leaves us wondering about the possibilities, and it should make us curious. Make us skeptical, but not in a just disregarding way, but in a curious way. And that's how I approach a lot of this as a skeptic, not because I want to be dismissive, because it doesn't fit into my worldview or something, because I'm curious about how the claims of all of these extraordinary things if true, which is an incredible thing, if these are all real,
that's right,
there's always the possibility that some of this can be, that we have to really account for not only the reality of these things being real, but how that has to be reworked and reconfigured into society in a safe way, in a way that's not going to completely upend things and cause civil, you know, disruption.
Well, I mean, hey, that's quite literally why NASA had 12 theologians on a panel. You know, was because anything like this happens, that it's going to upend society. There's going to be some shakeup with religion. There's going to be some shakeup with politics. It's going to be there. And when you hear people like Michio Kaku, I don't even see it as Michio Kaku, like, changing his tune. He's just looking at it more from the idea of, once again, the scientific method. If people have observed something and they had a question, buddy, they're already scientists. Like, the science has begun. Did you buy a ticket for the train? You know? even as an experiencer, as soon as I've had an experience, that the way I put it is, somebody has taken a crowbar and widened your keyhole through which you view the world. Once that happens, there's no going back. The science has begun. The question is whether or not you are willing to research the topic area more. And even like Avi Loeb, once again, I got no problems with Avi Loeb. He's forming a hypothesis, and that hypothesis can be as wild as you want it to be with science. It can be as crazy as you want it to be. What it comes down to from there is testing it with experiments, you know? And reining it in and analyzing data and reporting conclusions. And then, oddly enough, the whole process starts over again. Because with all of that, now what are your observations and questions? And does that change the way you research the topic? You know? So, yeah, it's cool to see science coming our way and considering these things and reconsidering these things. And as you know, Daniel, part of my personal mission over the last couple years has been trying to pry open the digits of paranormal so that we can start calling these things something other than paranormal, because that's why science wants no part of it. They don't like a blanket term like Kleenex. It's facial tissue, and there's thousands of types of facial tissue. There's pleated, there's non-pleated, there's double ply, single ply, there's quilted, non-quilted, scented, unscented, lotioned, unlotioned, numerous things, and even other brands that are not called Kleenex. But we as people, ethnographically, tend to want a very tight, concise definition to things in society. So we call every facsimile a Xerox. We call every tissue a Kleenex. We call every soda a Coke. When there's thousands of sodas in the aisle, hundreds of choices, even amongst the orange flavored drinks, there's a good 5 to choose from, you know? So you can't just say it's a soda or a pop or something like that. You with science, you have to get down into the dirt. You have to be willing to break that apart and break it into its constituent parts of genus, phylum, species, not just it's an animal with 4 legs. You know,
I think that's what's helpful about looking at a lot of these different things. Just the UFO topic, even the term UFO implies something unknown. And I think that it's conflated often with alien spaceship. And in some way, scientifically, that becomes a challenge. And you're absolutely right with some of those. In another way, for the purposes of pop culture, it's perfect. You know, so you have the dichotomy of the effect it has on society as a social construct, as a form of maybe social engineering, or maybe, as you said earlier, just the ways in which things are used despite the reality in order to generate motivation towards a cause or something. In this case, you know, you were showing the images of these, you know, CGI basically, or whether it's AI generated or computer generated.
It ain't real.
It's one of those things.
It ain't the actual picture, whatever.
It's more impressionable. Right. It's not the actual, because it's not interesting, you know? So it's one of those things that we find that the purpose of why things are made in certain ways have an effect on society. And I think that it's not really one or the other. It's a myriad of things. It's a whole spectrum of how we operate.
That's right.
In the sense of communication socially, how we understand pop culture, how we understand science, and the sort of blend between those things, how we understand mythology. And a lot of that really, I think, comes down to just the nature of our cultural lens of the human condition and how we mythologize things to the point of where UFO, you know, if we're talking about the scientific term, it immediately becomes a problem, because a UFO will indefinitely mean something unknown.
That's right.
Scientifically. But you shift gears a little bit, or you reorient the context of the ways in which it's utilized, and then becomes we're talking about aliens or something like that. And in a way in which people can easily understand it, it's almost more effective. And I think that that's where it's a challenge to understand for many people who either are, you know, they're on one track of everything has to be this way.
Yep.
And in some way we forget that the effective place of how things are communicated sometimes with the intention is so that it can really make things work or become understood or aware.
Yeah.
For the purpose of something that's not scientifically related.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot that goes with that. But I would say that just seeing how some of these things work in a way that we can pursue them scientifically, I think is important. There's a big part of me that I think yearns for that. I think if I were ever to like venture back into academics, I would love to be able to kind of wholeheartedly dive into those things. But a part of me also realizes that it can't only be those things. And in some way, not because it's just I want it to, but because of how society operates. We utilize communication in different ways. Not everything is technical communication.
Yeah.
And I think that when it comes to the people who have made effort, the groups, individuals, whatever it is, to try to understand some of these incredible, notable cases, whether they're well known for being seen as legitimate or illegitimate, it works in both or any of these arenas. So, you know, UFO cases, whether you're talking about people who've described abductions or just sightings or interactions with non-human entities, or you talk about the cryptid arena with people who describe interactions with what they refer to as Bigfoot or other cryptids. There are groups, and there have been people for years, for decades, who have gone and tried to make sense of very scientifically where these things can land so that we can provide some real insight as to what actually occurred. And I think all of that's incredibly important. But at the same time, we can't also forget that there are people who look at this psychologically.
Yep.
Sociologically, and in some way, the ways in which these things are interpreted, in some way, many people often ascribe to this idea that when people say that they see a UFO, I think it's often chalked up either, you know, because they're not in a solid state of mind or whatever it is, or that they're experiencing a projection of their subconscious. Now, I think both of those things absolutely do happen, but also I think that the other and many other things is that there are definitely are things that people are seeing, and many of them are probably not alien in any way, and are probably experimental or secretive aviation projects. And I think that that's probably been going on the whole time.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I think it's the ways in which we interpret it. And we know that there are different stories about people who see and encounter aerial objects or debris or whatever it is and have the impression that it's non-human, and then are told that it is despite it not being the case. And so you have a lot of these different things that are happening to reinforce ideas that are already present in the human psyche and the social psyche of this idea. It's, you know, we're heavily embedded in, especially in pop culture, about aliens and things like this. It's from this point on always going to be with us.
That's right.
Whether it's actually happening or not. And I think that that's the challenge, is knowing scientifically we're up against the sort of social constructs that are already embedded that are saying these things are real, when science is showing that we just don't have what it takes scientifically through demonstrable repetition.
That's right.
To make these things applicable consistently. So one of the challenges of cryptid reports is that we can't duplicate these things on a consistent basis across the board, because if we could, then it would put to rest so much. And I think that the challenge is that that only speaks to the people who are only interested in trying to achieve the scientific result. It's not going to convince or change the minds of people who already are set that, like, oh yeah, I mean, this happened to me, I know it's real, or heard enough about this that I'm okay for that to be enough for me to believe that it's real. So we're left with this challenge of seeing how we have independent citizen fronted groups doing citizen science to the best of their ability, citizen journalism, trying to go out and do what they can. A good example when it comes to cryptozoology, specifically the Bigfoot phenomenon, is a group called the Bluff Creek Project, who I was fortunate enough to go and meet up with on location out in Bluff Creek in 2021. The summer of 2021, I was on an expedition, cryptid expedition led by world-renowned cryptozoologist Ken Gerhardt, our good friend and colleague. And I think that one of the things that I was fortunate to do was meet up with this Bluff Creek Project group to show that they have mathematically mapped out where, to the closest of their ability, the original Patterson-Gimlin film took place. The one where we all see the notable subject that's got its arms, you know, and the legs, we call Patty, that frame 352 of that film, in a way that has become an icon, a global icon, and is used all over pop culture to represent this fun, weird, and strange idea of this very human-like creature or person that's covered in hair. And whether it's real or not, it's left a lasting impression on society. But what this group has done is taken it upon themselves, because there's not a lot of other efforts, to really do what they can with their resources and their background to try to figure out where such an impressionable film was made, and to get down to the origins of this location to see if there's something we can understand about it that not only gives it credence, but that can just show what it is or isn't. And I think that's the important part about science, is in some way, yes, we can be driven with our heart and to have passion for things. We can romanticize things and want for things to be true. I feel like I I'm a romantic. I romanticize. I love this idea that there can be a creature or many creatures out there in this world or beyond. I would love for that to be the case. But I also have to be level-headed and objective in another way that says that, look, despite my interest and passion for these things, it's also okay to have a dispassionate outlook to say that, look, despite there being this maybe consideration for a reality of these things, that maybe there's also equally or enough so a potential of there being a non-reality for some of these things as well. And I think it's okay, because science will help us to give us results either way.
Yeah.
Which whether it's results showing that there's enough of something to say that there is, or not enough of something to show us that there's it's indeterminable. It's not enough to say one way or the other.
That's right.
And I think that's where a lot of these times, you know, we say that, you know, because there's not enough information, it must mean that there isn't anything. But ultimately, that's not what it means. It means that there's just insufficient data, and it's left open-ended, which is still kind of a hopeful thing for those of us who may like for there to be the possibility still.
Well, and scientifically, the lack of evidence is not the proof of non-existence. Those two things are not the same. A lack of evidence of something does not mean that the problem doesn't exist, you know? And it's interesting. I am one of the many people who is a fan of change from UFO to UAP. And I understand it was done dirty, folks. It was done behind the scenes. And probably, to be like, well, we ain't looking into UFOs anymore. Sorry. Had you known we were looking into UAPs, your FOIA would have gone through. however, I hold in my hand an amazing book that I got called Strange Phenomena. I got this in a series of, this is an actual, like, lab book sit on your desk reference of strange phenomena, everything from, you know, water spouts to ball lightning to gas phenomena like swamp gas lighting things, you know, St. Elmo's fire, things like that, that go back to the 1700s. Articles about them. That's a scientific desk reference. So science is all about phenomena. They have to actively remove it from their data set. Like, that's a part of science that you have to get rid of to show that your results are actually your results and not being influenced by something outside, you know? So you have to exclude phenomena from your data set. So you fully have to know what the phenomena is. And that's just it. Like, we've brought science in kicking and screaming by changing that name. And it's great. Because it is that conversation of, if we aren't using the same nomenclature as science, are they going to listen? You know?
Right. One thing I would say has been challenging with it, though. One personal pet peeve I have that is kind of irrelevant, I guess, but it's like when people add the S on the end of UAP,
yeah.
UAPs, because it's already either plural. It's like UFOs. Like, honestly, UFOs could be plural.
No, phenomena say, is already
you could
plural.
You UFO.
Look, but yeah, phenomena is already pluralized,
right? But that's just semantics, so it's not a big deal. But the other is that the official change was also not just from unidentified aerial phenomenon to unidentified anomalous
phenomena.
So I think in some way that opens the breadth of
further.
what it is even more, but
exactly.
Almost in such a way that's like, well, now we're not just talking about things in the sky. So with that same context, if we say that, like, a lot of the congressional hearings, for instance, if we're bringing in UAP witnesses, but they're all talking about UFOs for the sake of conversation.
Sure.
I think we're also limiting the whole point of changing it from aerial to anomalous when the reality is that, you know, you're eventually going to have to acknowledge that in doing so. The implication is that we're not just talking about aerial phenomena. We're
That's
talking
right.
about any
underwater phenomena.
Other,
we're talking about all kinds of phenomena.
And I think it's also, you know, we in the UFO arena, you know, there's this idea about transmedium objects, things that can go from water
and
to
non-human
air
intelligence.
To space.
Non-human
same,
intelligence.
Same kind of thing.
You know,
and I think that those terms, well, many of them have been around for a long time, but the official nomenclature is what has, I guess, been updated in a way that can, like you said, just be applied for the sake of officialdom. And I think in some way we can see that, you know, in the civilian sector or pop culture blend of like how we just communicate in society, the military application. And which also blends into the official government application.
That's right.
Which in some way can then blend into the official or like scientific application. So in some way, they're all the language models used are all important in their own context, but it's also something that has a little bit of crossover and then a little bit more specificity depending on what exactly it is we're dealing with, which is what the original challenge of UFO is that it is not specific. It is literally like,
as open-ended as possible.
Right. And so I think that's why, like you said, depending on, you know, how we look at it and with a specified change, it allows us to get down to a more definitive area for the sake of science.
Yeah.
And the scope of society as a general area of interest as pop culture, it might not be as an effective thing because we switch from, you know, one term to the other.
Yeah.
And it's hard for many people who are not scientifically minded to get on board. So I think that the dichotomy there or dilemma or whatever it is that people are arguing from different vantage points about something which is ultimately not
the exact same
not
thing.
Supposed to be this or that. It's another idea that has context. And so I think oftentimes things get lost in translation or the communication is not effectively made because we lose sense of what the context is. And I think that ultimately you see this same type of interaction happen across the board from ufology to cryptozoology to parapsychology. But I think that if applied under the scientific lens, we can get ultimately very specific, like ultra specific with detail, because that's how it has to work.
And we have
the
to.
Technical rigidity, I think, is amazing. But for the sake of casual conversation, things often are made a little bit different for the effects. And I think that's where people forget That's the reason we have conversations the way we have, is because not everyone's going to understand from the scientific vantage point of those things in a way that the bulk of society will be able to digest it. And I think that's where the language models used in these various groups are made to be digested in a way that caters toward either people already in that focused group.
Yeah.
Or they're made to be in an attempt to be scientific, or they're made to garner the attention of anybody that can understand the lowest common denominator of the subject. And I think that's where TV shows have to gear towards, because they know that these shows aren't made just for the people who are interested. They're made to try to garner the attention of someone who otherwise is flipping channels and says, "Oh, I've heard about UFOs."
And to make somebody interested.
Right.
Is the key of them. And that's just it. And that, as we close things out here, I think that is one of the most important things, Daniel, is to get people to understand that, as a scientist, nobody is trying to say that none of this exists. What they're trying to do is get a classification of what does exist, you know, and as those of us who are experiencers, and we have to get them okay with looking at the red circle on a picture, you know, we have to get science okay with accepting a picture with a red circle on it. But we, as the takers of the red circle picture, have to be willing to accept the explanation of what's in that red circle when provided it. And understand that the explanation of that does not remove the observation in question that began this scientific inquiry. It doesn't remove that. It doesn't remove that magnificent moment that changed your life and your perspective on the world around you. Just because what is in that red circle is explained doesn't remove the moment that you took the picture and questioned. And that's the important thing of what you've done by giving the scientist the picture with the red circle and the scientist explaining what's in the red circle. You have now expanded the realm of known quantitative in the field, which only further narrows the paranormal. You know, you've only narrowed the gap of paranormal and known quantitative. You've actively contributed to the scientific process by giving your red circle and by accepting what's in it. You know, because only by fully defining the known quantitative can we have the remainder, which is the 3 to 5% phenomena.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think that's it. I think just some final thoughts on all of it is essentially that, you know, all of these subjects, I think, in their own respective way, ufology, you know, amazing potential for there to be exploration to the possibility of not just unknown objects, but what that implies and what it insinuates a lot of people is that there are engineering capabilities, there are manufacturing capabilities, not only by humans, but by potentially something, someone else, somewhere else, that we have yet to acknowledge on a public collective scale consistently. But I think that despite that very, you know, challenging, the chance for that is very minimal. But in some way, despite that, I think it still offers the ability to promote the awareness of tangential, subjects or things that are essentially going to be related to space, technology, you know, astronomy. It allows us to also develop an affinity for something beyond our world and our world as well. But same thing, you know, cryptozoology. If any of these cryptids are real, amazing. But if that's only what we're looking for, then we're neglecting ourselves from being able to also develop an appreciation and compassion for wildlife that's already known, the things that we can already do and explore.
That's right.
So I find not only for myself do I find that what is ultimately cultivated from looking into these things for years is that, you know, we're not always going to be able to find the answers probably within our lifetime, maybe, but the ultimate idea is that what we can cultivate for sure is just the affinity for what is for humanity and beyond, for the world we live in and all the wildlife within it.
That's right.
How we can do what we can to, with knowing that, work together to develop a better place for our world and for each other. And this place that we get to share with these amazing life forms. And so I think it's important to see that despite there not necessarily being an ultimate answer to did case X, Y, and Z have a reality to it, yes or no. And I think that, you know, it's not always black and white, like yes, it happened or no, it didn't happen. But what can we culminate from seeing that there's not just the idea of it being real or not real, but how that affects on us as people and as a greater society will leave a lasting impression for generations to come. That's for right. us to understand the implications and potential for what we can do to further understand science, the ways in which we explore our own modern folklore, our history, and where we can go from there to, again, to just develop compassion for each other.
Yep.
And this wondrous world that we live in. And so I think that's through developing this work in ethnography that I found a sense of fulfillment, is that I don't find that it's given me answers to some of these really challenging questions. It's allowed me to see it differently and allowed me to be able to share what I've done in a way that explores the cultural aspects of these things in these areas as well.
Well, and I think also allowed you to stomp down a lot of stereotypes, Daniel, that have stigmatized people on both sides, both scientifically and community-wise. You know, so good for you for stereotype stomping. That's what it's all about, man, is to widen people's perspectives to begin with. And it's great to see what you were doing with your research, and much like Kathleen Martin, to see this pivot in your research into something that is, I think, a much larger facet than just a case or just a series of cases. You know, it's one of those, if every facet on a gem is not there or is not polished, then a gem doesn't sparkle right. You know, an uncut gem without facets is not that pretty most of the time. Like, feel free to go take a look at an uncut diamond, folks. It just looks like a silverish rock. You know, it's pretty unassuming as a diamond in the rough. But once you start cutting, once you start polishing that, and once you start honing that rock, different things come out, different things come about. And that's just it, Daniel. After, I think, years, a decade now, of the hard research that you've done with good people like Jim Mars and others, you have really had a chance to see the way that these diamonds are crafted from the outside and from a distance, and have a very unique perspective on the way that these communities move together, coalesce together, and the way that they socially impact each other, and the way that these things are impacting our society right now as they are bubbling to a head. So thank you for your decade of work, and thank you for your continued work in this. I can't wait to see where else you take it, bud.
Well, thanks, Chris. I think it's just an interesting time. You know, it's one way to see how things work. It's also important to see how they don't work. And sometimes that is the case. And so it's really just a matter of providing the information out there. There's a lot of really great things coming up that I think people can get an opportunity, as you know, going out, being a part of a physical gathering, going to conferences, going to events. It's a great experience. You don't have to believe anything at all. You can just enjoy the company and hear some fun stories, or just get into it or not. And so I think that one of the cool things is being able to get together. We've got the Edinburgh UFO Festival and Conference coming up. There's going to be a lot of really interesting things that people can do with that. And just have a fun, great time. And that's going to be November 20th, 21st, and 22nd of this year. And so we're really looking forward to that. And another number of other things coming up as well. I know we've got some shows probably here coming up pretty soon that I'm looking forward to being able to get together with you again.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that, you know, as an example, I'm very grateful to be able to kind of be able to share and to help develop communities in a way that does have opportunities for people to get together at events like this. The Edinburgh event, I've been fortunate to be working with the city on for a number of years now. It's a long running event. It's the longest running UFO related event in Texas at this point. And so we hope that, you know, we're looking forward to getting together with everyone at that and all the other fun stuff going on. We got Craig Woolheater's Texas Bigfoot Conference coming up in October before that as well. So it's a great time. And I think that's really just something that allows us to get together to take part in really connecting more than just the ideas of what we can look at online. And I think it's fulfilling and rewarding in many ways to be able to collectively gather, congregate and enjoy our company. And I think, you know, it's something that everyone should have an opportunity to check out as well.
Well, I firmly agree. That is why I go out and cover these things. That's why I get out into the communities and do that kind of stuff, because it is the conversation. That's what's important. So, and we'll get into that in a second. But Daniel, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow you, the Vortex, all that kind of good stuff for everything that is para, because you are out there in so many communities. So, one last time before we go, where can everybody keep track of you and everything that you do, bud?
So I'm pretty well easy to get a hold of on all social media, Facebook, Instagram, X. It's just, as you can see, my name, full name, Daniel Allen Jones. I manage a media platform called The Vortex, which really is just a YouTube channel. You can go to youtube.com/TheVortex1, like the number one, and you can see some of the videos I have. It's going to perpetually be like archived footage because I don't have any time to ever upload any new content. So it's something that I'm just going to eventually just turn into an archive database of things that are not relevant or current, because it's hard to keep up with it. So hats off to you for being able to maintain and manage the upkeep of a show that has lots of great content, guests, information. There's a lot to it. That's why I said earlier, you know, great job on doing everything you're doing. There's so much behind the scenes that most people don't ever see that is where the real work happens. And so I just, I want to commend you and everyone listening for the effort that goes into all of this. So, feel free for anyone else who wants to reach out. I'm, you know, also, you know, open to continue the discussion and hopefully just go from there.
Absolutely. Daniel, it's always great having you on. It's always a breath of fresh air chatting with you and banging these things around, because really it is one of those for me that, I have been of the mind for decades now. Art Bell was right. There is a quickening. There is something happening amongst humanity that it's like a Tom and Jerry snowball rolling down a hill. Something is boiling to a head, and it is really interesting to see where our society has come just since you and I have been friends, how these topics have been broken open in society and just flayed open on the pit. So it'll be interesting to see what cooks up in society from all this stuff. Thank you as always for your time, Daniel. Hold the line while we close things out real quick. While you were online checking out everything from Daniel Allen Jones and the Vortex, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find our events page full of amazing episodes from on-site events. Like Texas Bigfoot that we've been at the past few years, like Cygames, like Roswell UFO Festival, Lone Star Paracon, and so many more. That is where you can also find your link to Curious Research. This is our effort to help paranormal researchers shake hands with science and science get ready to meet the paranormal. There are all kinds of new things on there, folks. If you go over to Free Tools, this is a fantastic new page that we have added that has all kinds of actual free online things that you can use to help your investigations. Forensically Beta, which is a great photograph program to show you EXIF data and all kinds of other things inside of your stuff. Sonic Visualizer, things like that, as well as the new Experiencer support tab. Go over to curiousresearch.org/support, and you can find our protocols for Awakening Together, the first of its kind paranormal support group, totally anonymous. You start your own chapter. There are the precepts, the pillars, how to run a meeting, how to keep things open-minded, open-hearted, not religious, not political, things like that. So stop on by, check all that great stuff out, everybody. Thank you so much for your time, as always. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.